In Illinois and many states, if you work at a fast food franchise, so-called no poaching agreements can keep you from getting a better job at a different restaurant location.
So there's a significant concern that this is being used in a way that is illegal, in addition to the fact that it is depressing people's wages.
That's Attorney General Lisa Madigan. We talk more about her investigation into fast food hiring. Plus, soy is king in Illinois and in China. How's that trade war working out?
It's the economy, stupid. You know, my vote will depend an awful lot on the farm economy. That's just the world I live in.
Farmer Brian Duncan speaking with VOA News. I'm Brian Mackey. Today on the 21st, we talk about how that could affect farmers' bottom lines and their politics. Plus, what residents of small towns are doing to try and reverse the brain drain. That's all coming up on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey, in for Nyla Boodoo. Some fast food chains in Illinois and across the country have clauses in their franchise agreements that prevent workers from getting jobs at other locations of the same restaurant owned by a different franchisee. And in many cases, workers don't even know about it. Let's say you work at a Dunkin' Donuts. You find out there are better or more hours available at a location a mile away, but if it's owned by a different franchisee, you might not be able to get the new job. This is because of what's referred to as no poaching clauses. They exist in a wide variety of industries, but Attorney General Lisa Madigan here in Illinois has launched an investigation focused on fast food restaurants. She's joining with several other state attorneys general to demand information from 8 fast food companies, Burger King, Dunkin' Donuts, as I mentioned, plus Five Guys Burgers and Fries, Little Caesars, Panera Bread, Popeyes, Louisiana Kitchen, Wendy's, and Arby's. We should say Arby's has since announced plans to end its requirement that franchisees not hire workers from other Arby's franchisees. To talk with us more about no-poach agreements and how they affect workers, we're joined by Eric Posner, a law professor at the University of Chicago who's been researching these practices. Eric, welcome to the 21st.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
So I mentioned some different no-poach scenarios a minute ago. How common is this practice?
Well, there are two types of situations that one might think about. One is the no-poach agreements within franchises, which is the focus of the recent news and these investigations. Independent firms sometimes enter into no-poaching agreements as well. Famously, a few years ago, tech companies in California were found to have done that, and they were punished by the U.S. government. But if you just focus on the franchises, the best estimate is probably more than half of all franchises in the United States have used these no poaching clauses.
So, is this a new practice, or is this something that's growing, or has it been growing in recent years?
It's growing. If you go back to 1996, about a third of the franchises used no poaching clauses. So I think it's been around for a while, but accelerated in the last couple decades.
And is this, you mentioned, so tech companies were doing this sort of among each other, and we're talking about sort of restaurant fast food franchises. Are there other industries where we see this sort of thing?
Well, so when companies that are not part of a franchise engage in no poaching agreements, that's clearly a violation of antitrust law, so they keep it secret. And so the only reason why we found out about the tech companies is that there was some whistleblowing which alerted the U.S. government. So there's no way to know how frequently no poaching agreements are used outside of the franchise world. The reason why we know about the franchises is that for a long time, it was believed that no poaching clauses within franchises were actually lawful, that they didn't violate U.S. antitrust law. So the franchises could include them in their agreements without, at least initially, worrying that they were violating the law.
How did we find out, or what changed our thinking on that? Why are they now looked at as something more skeptically or suspiciously?
So these were this was a change in the law. Under antitrust law, independent firms are not allowed to enter into agreements that are considered anti-competitive, for example, to fix prices or to raise prices, and also to refuse to hire each other's workers. So that's clearly illegal. Now, what's different about a franchise is that they're structured so that each individual restaurant is, in a way, not independent. So if you take, for example, McDonald's, one location, suppose you have two locations that are near each other. So those two locations wouldn't enter into a no poaching agreement with each other. They don't need to do that. The way it works is that they have independent agreements or franchise agreements with McDonald's headquarters outside of Chicago. And because the courts used to consider a franchise what they called a common enterprise, these sorts of no poaching arrangements weren't considered illegal. So if you could think of if McDonald's were just a single corporation the way Walmart is, so Walmart mm-hmm. doesn't use the franchise structure, you know, it can obviously decide to, you know, it wouldn't make much sense to say that, you know, you can't hire one of your own employees after firing that person. You know, that doesn't make any sense. And so courts were for a while persuaded that it would similarly not make any sense to say that McDonald's couldn't tell one of its franchisees that it couldn't hire somebody who was working for another McDonald's franchisee. But over the last, decade or so, the courts have backed away from this common enterprise theory. And so it increasingly appears to be the case that no poaching arrangements within franchises are just as illegal as no poaching arrangements between independent companies.
So a moment ago, you mentioned that, you know, we might not know. These things could be happening. We wouldn't know about it because they're illegal if it's in other industries. I wonder, is that why or why, I should ask, are attorneys general focusing on fast food workers in this context?
Well, I think, you know, they should be focusing on franchises in general, not just fast food workers. I suspect they focus on fast food workers because they're, you know, low-income people who are hurt by this arrangement much more than, you know, maybe higher income workers who are in different types of franchises that are maybe pay better, maybe because people are more highly skilled. So, for example, if you have a franchise that, I don't know, sells cars or repairs cars, maybe the workers are not as vulnerable or not hurt as much. But I do think that the attorneys general should focus on franchises in general because these no poaching agreements do cause harm to workers. And, you know, harm to higher income workers is still a problem and one that the state should have an interest in preventing.
Well, sticking, you mentioned fast food workers are often low income workers. What's one of the reasons somebody might want to leave one franchise, go to a different franchise down the road?
So it's a funny kind of situation because the franchises compete with each other, or the franchisees, I should say, the different locations compete with each other, even though they're working under the umbrella of a single organization. And that's really supposed to be how it works. So imagine you have two McDonald's locations a few miles apart from each other. The owner of the McDonald's location wants to make profits. And one way to make profits is not to pay your workers very much, or maybe to subject them to harsher working conditions. And so if you do that, your worker might say, well, I quit, and go to the other McDonald's franchise location and speak to the manager there. And maybe the manager at that other location offers a somewhat better deal. And so then the worker will go to another McDonald's location and, you know, have a little better pay maybe, or a little better hours, or just better working conditions. And so that would be, and, you know, you might ask, why would the worker want to work for another McDonald's? Why not go find work at another restaurant or type of business? And of course, a worker might do that, but it might be just easier to find work in another McDonald's location because the production practices are similar and the person has a little bit of training or knowledge about how McDonald's restaurants generally work.
Yeah, yeah. So we spoke to the workers' rights group Fight for 15, which told us about a woman who experienced some of these similar issues to what franchise workers in Illinois seem to be. She wasn't able to join us, unfortunately, today, but I can share she worked part-time at a McDonald's in Iowa. She needed more hours than she was being scheduled, so she found a job at another McDonald's that could give her, you know, more shifts. And it wasn't until she was actually sitting in orientation that her manager said, "Can't have this job." So she eventually did find a job at another McDonald's, but she didn't disclose that she had previously worked at a McDonald's. I should say we're using McDonald's as an example, but they are not right. One of the companies being targeted by the Attorney General because they announced plans to remove these clauses last year. From the company's standpoint, why is this valuable to a company? Are they, you know, just worried about workers shifting around willy-nilly, losing people?
Well, the companies have, you know, two possible reasons for using no poaching agreements. One reason is legitimate and the other is illegitimate. The legitimate reason is that, you know, it may be the case that the first franchisee that hires someone gives that person some training, the person learns the ropes, and that's costly for the restaurant. So if the worker, you know, quits and goes and works for another restaurant, there's a sense in which the first restaurant is kind of subsidizing the second restaurant. And you know, businesses don't want to train people so that they can work for competitors. So that's a kind of an understandable reason why businesses put some constraints on what workers can do after they leave. But the illegitimate reason is a lot more serious and I think more plausible in the setting of low-income workers who generally don't receive very much training. And that is simply that it makes it easier to underpay workers or to subject them to harsher conditions or, as you put it, as in your example, give them less attractive terms, like fewer shifts. And the point here is simply that our economy works through competition. And the way that workers are able to get reasonable pay and reasonable conditions is basically because they can threaten to leave one place and go work for another place. That's what keeps workers in line. That's what keeps employers in line. And so if employers can prevent that from happening by entering into agreements with each other, that harms workers themselves and just basically how the labor market is supposed to work.
Hmm. Well, we reached out to the International Franchise Association as well. They sent a statement. Vice President Matt Holler said, franchising provides a path of employment, job training, and career advancement for employees on a large scale. As preeminent stakeholders on this issue, the IFA hopes lawmakers are willing to engage with us in a constructive way to find a solution that protects workers' rights and promotes economic growth. The statement goes on to say that every brand is different, but you know a lot of companies are eliminating these anti-poaching clauses on their own, and they reiterate that they're open to working with lawmakers on this. You talked about not wanting to train an employee and then have them go somewhere else to a competing franchise. And that makes sense. And that kind of reminds me of these non-compete clauses, which is something else I know you've written about. And I interviewed Attorney General Lisa Madigan about this, I asked her about, you know, when she took the Jimmy John's chain to court over these agreements. That company eventually dropped them. And I asked her about the parallels to her investigation of the no poaching agreements.
You again have a circumstance where low-income workers, and predominantly those that are in the fast food industry, are being prevented from getting a better job and therefore earning higher wages to better support themselves and their families. In both circumstances, it may be for slightly different reasons that these terms are illegal, but the result is exactly the same. You have people who are already struggling to be able to support themselves and their families being, you know, further and illegally prevented from getting a better and higher paying job.
So, Eric, I want to ask you, do you see parallels between the non-compete clauses, no poaching clauses?
Oh, yes, they're very similar. They basically do the same thing. The only difference is that the non-compete clauses are broader and, in a sense, worse. So in the case of a non-compete clause, if I work for let's say, I don't know, Burger King, and there's a non-compete clause, not only can I not work for another Burger King, I also can't work for McDonald's or Jimmy John's or any other restaurant in the industry. So I really have few choices. If basically all I'm able to do is work as a kind of a fast food worker. By contrast, the no poaching agreement's narrower. It only prevents me from working for a franchisee in the same, you know, under the same organization. So I couldn't work for another Burger King, but I could work for a McDonald's. So the covenants not to compete are actually a lot more serious, and I think the state was right in going after Jimmy John's for using them.
Well, we've only got about a minute left, but I want to ask, you know, there's a lot of attention now on these no poaching agreements. We've also heard a lot in the last few years about fair wages and possibly raising the minimum wage. I'm wondering, again, briefly, what other things should we be thinking about when it comes to protecting workers, particularly lower income workers?
Well, two things come to mind. One is that the government should pay much more attention to mergers between employers that can reduce the choice that workers have. So, for example, you know, farm equipment dealers have merged. And so workers who can repair farm equipment very well but aren't really trained in other things have less choice, and that means that they can be paid lower wages by the employer. Now, that type of merger is potentially illegal. The government has not paid much attention to those mergers, but I think there's good reason to think that mergers among employers have reduced wages considerably. And the other thing is, you know, everybody talks about the gig economy and Uber and the efforts to misclassify employees as independent contractors, as Uber has done, in my view, is another way that workers have been harmed. And that also should get a lot of attention.
Well, I'm afraid we have to leave it there. Eric Posner is a professor of law at the University of Chicago. He's been researching and writing about the issue of no poaching laws. Eric, thanks so much for being here.
My pleasure.
Welcome to the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey in for Nyla Boodoo. We've been hearing about the trade war with China for most of President Trump's administration. First, there was the anticipation, then the announcement of tariff hikes on Chinese imports. Now we have the potential fallout, especially here in Illinois. Illinois farmers have been one of the most vulnerable groups in this battle. Child is the world's largest buyer of American soybeans. U.S. farmers sell about a third of their soybeans there. And just last week, soybean prices hit a 10-year low. So what do these back-and-forth negotiations between our countries mean for farmers' bottom lines? And for a group that's traditionally been core Republican voters, what will that mean come election time? We're going to hear from some farmers across the state in a bit. But first, Mike Doherty is a senior economist for the Illinois Farm Bureau. He's with us now. Mike, welcome to the 21st.
Hi, thank you. Appreciate it.
So, Mike, this is not the first news about trade and tariffs over the past few months. Can you walk us back through some of the decisions that we've been seeing from the Trump administration regarding these trade tariff policies?
Yeah, it started back in March when President Trump announced the aluminum and steel tariffs on imports. And then in response to those, later in March, China announced tariffs on U.S. exports and included a tariff, 25% tariff on pork products from the United States, and then added to that a 25% tariff on soybeans. And that went on through April and mid-May, and then we ended up with also then tariffs against Mexico, and Mexico retaliated in kind on those, putting tariffs against our pork and exports to Mexico.
And I think arguably the decisions that affect farmers could go back even further if you talk about the Trans-Pacific Partnership and the possibility of renegotiating NAFTA. I don't know that it's necessarily something that springs to mind that affects farmers, but can you talk about that as well?
Yeah, early on, you know, with this administration, the decision was made to pull out of the negotiations of the TPP that you just referenced, a multi-country trade agreement. And so that was kind of like the first signal that we might not be as aggressive in the future about doing multi-country trade agreements as we had in the past. And it kind of just went from there, became even more, at least from the standpoint of agriculture as an industry, more the administration took us in a more anti-trade direction from that point. And at first, the markets didn't really overreact to that, but once the tariffs were really announced by our two biggest customers we have, which is China on soybeans and Mexico, both with pork and with corn, and China number three actually on pork as well, two of our biggest agricultural customers, then our prices took a hit at each of those announcements. You could see the price decline on the futures contract prices for corn and soybeans.
You know, you mentioned this sort of anti-trade direction, but one phrase we're hearing a lot lately is trade war, especially in light of these latest tariffs on Chinese imports. What do people mean when they say trade war? I mean, is that the right term to be using?
Economists are still arguing about whether we're really in a trade war or not, but if you're in agriculture, it certainly feels like one. When they refer to it as a war, they mean that you're lobbying, like rather than lobbying shells at each other across your borders, you're lobbying tariffs against each other. So one country says, well, we're going to add 25% to the price of your goods that you're importing into our country, into the United States. We're going to add 25% to that price. And then that other country, are going to do their own calculations on their own, saying, well, we're going to increase the price of your goods that you sell to us by 25%. See how you like that? And the reason it's a war is because, you know, one action can create or provoke a reaction that then provokes another reaction over on the other side. So it can escalate as countries add more goods to the list or more ways in which they're going to retaliate.
I've been fascinated by some of the specificity of these tariffs that we've seen in retaliation. You know, the bourbon in Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell's district, the Harley-Davidson plant in House Speaker Paul Ryan's district. And then, of course, farm tariffs, which affect a lot of presumably Trump core Republican Trump constituencies in Iowa and here in downstate Illinois. I'm wondering, how important is trade to the Illinois farm economy, right? Is this something?
Right.
Yeah, go ahead.
I feel like part of the reason agriculture sort of was an immediate target for tariffs is because it is one of the few industries in the United States economy that is a net exporter. It's a foreign exchange earner. We sell more overseas than we buy when it comes to agricultural products. And so in a couple of those countries, well, particularly China, is very dependent on importing enormous quantities of soybeans every year. They do not grow their own. They don't have the water supplies or the infrastructure to be doing that. And they've made a decision in terms of their national planning to buy soybeans from basically from the United States and from Brazil and from Argentina. And so it was kind of an obvious target. It was to go after these massive amounts of soybeans that are being imported there. And where do they grow? Well, they just happen to grow in what we call the corn belt, but it's really the corn-soybean belt. And Illinois just happens to be the most export in terms of agricultural products and corn and soybeans. We are the most export dependent because we do not have as much livestock in Illinois to consume that corn and soybeans as do neighboring states. Like Iowa has a very large hog herd population and inventory. We don't have that. So we are much more dependent on selling our corn, our soybeans, our soybean meal out of state, which means we're also much more dependent on international markets.
Is this effect on Illinois farmers going to be felt in other industries, potentially?
You're definitely going to see it. Well, to some extent, they've already pulled in their belts tighten their belts over the last 5 years. This is year number five of low farm income in Illinois, and that's because of we've had 5 years in a row of fairly low corn and soybean prices. We've been fortunate up till now that in several of the last 5 years we had unusually high soybean yields, and that really kind of saved us. And we had a bump up for a short time in price, and farmers were able to price their crop at that moment. This year, not only prices are down, but the forecasts are we may well be back to what they call trend yield on soybeans, which means we are going to have a even more significant drop in farm income, somewhere around 60% drop compared to last year, according to University of Illinois figures, and or more. And that means farmers are really going to have to rethink their rental agreements. Well, 80% of the acreage in the central Illinois high productivity land is rented from landlords, and that those landlords, half of them live in our towns. They are bankers and doctors and dentists and people who have inherited farmland. So there's a cutback coming right there in terms of what farmers are going to be able to transfer or pay in rent to those other people in our community, plus pickup trucks, fertilizer, and everything else. So, yeah, when you look at the there's going to be an effect and a multiplier effect here in reverse, particularly in areas of Illinois, downstate, that are very agricultural, concentrated in agriculture, agriculturally dependent.
That's Mike Doherty. He's a senior economist for the Illinois Farm Bureau. Mike, thanks for joining us on the 21st.
Thank you very much. My pleasure.
According to a Washington Post analysis, soybean-producing countries went for President Trump by a margin of more than 12% during the 2016 election. Then in March, when there were already rumblings of a trade war, an AgriPulse survey of farmers in the Midwest showed that 67% said they voted for Trump, 45% said they would do so again. Let's hear from some farmers. Welcome them to the conversation. Paul Taylor farms corn, soybeans, and other specialty crops in Esmond near DeKalb County. He's also a former member of the Illinois Corn Board. Also joining us is Wendell Schauman. Wendell is a corn and soy farmer from western Illinois. He farms about 1,100 acres in Kirkwood, about 70 miles west of Peoria near the Mississippi River. He is a member of the Illinois Farm Bureau and a former chairman of the U.S. Grains Council. Paul, Wendell, welcome back to the 21st.
Thank you.
Good morning, and thank you.
Yeah, and Evan Hultin is also on the line. He's a soybean farmer from Bureau County, about 30 miles north of Peoria. Hello, Evan.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. Paul, I'd like to start with you. When we think of soy, not everyone might know how important it is to the Illinois economy. We heard a little bit about this earlier, but according to the USDA, more than 10 million acres of soybeans were harvested in Illinois in 2016. And nationally, they overtook corn as the most harvested crop in the country. Paul, where does most of this soy go?
Well, I think Steve did a great job of talking about the growth of the soybean export market, particularly the need for Illinois, particularly to export the soybeans. And, of course, the two main components of soybean are the protein meal that comes out of it that's used to feed livestock, poultry, and, of course, the other part is the oil that's primarily used for cooking oil, and that's one of the big draws in Asia.
And, I mean, how important are trade partnerships to this this relationship, this business relationship?
Well, I think trade is while we've used a lot of our commodities, particularly corn, for in the biofuel industry in the last 10 years or so, we've seen incredible growth there. The soybean side has primarily been, again, the meal and the oil. But if we could have been having this conversation 40 years ago, we would have been concerned about embargoes with Japan, with Russia, and trade, even though it sometimes is a smaller than the majority part of our production, because of the elasticity of the markets, is really important to help define our price, and we've seen that through this decline in the last few months.
Evan, how much soy do you export from your farm, and have these tariffs been affecting your business?
Yeah, absolutely. So we're located right by the Illinois River, so every bushel of soybeans we produce heads down to the river and heads out for export. So yeah, it's definitely been felt on our farm already, and we're pretty much debating if we're going to consider growing soybeans next year if this tariff situation doesn't straighten out quickly.
Wow, you'd actually change your crop just based on what's been happening.
Yeah, I mean, we've lost over $2 a bushel on our soybean price just here in the last few months. So, it's affected the corn market a little, but not near as drastically. And we need to, as Mike kind of alluded to, we need to tighten our belts and put forward the best plan we can to stay in business. So.
Huh. Wendell, you're a former chairman of the U.S. Grains Council. For those listening who aren't farmers, how much do you think these tariffs could affect the cost of our food?
Oh, might actually lower it. You've got more supply to use locally now. That's not a particular issue. It might affect us. Well, I don't think that's an issue at all for the consumer. Remember, Paul mentioned the embargo we put on soybeans about 40 years ago, maybe longer ago than that. This is different from that in my mind. Then we told the rest of the world we are no longer a reliable supplier. And what did the rest of the world do? Okay, if we can't trust you, we're going to go develop other markets so we've got alternative places to go. In this case, China unilaterally took the option of we're going to basically block you. We're going to put an embargo on your prices so you're non-competitive and Brazil will be cheaper and we'll get our beans there. Well, that will work for them for a while, but there's not enough beans in Brazil to totally supply their demand. The other part of that, in China, I don't have a lot of sympathy for them. They've blocked us on a number of products over the years. We developed a DDG market over there, and they found a reason to block us, filed a WTO suit. We fought that and basically won. Two or three years later, they blocked us again, and it doesn't look like we're going to get back into that market. They're restricting our access. They became an ethanol market. Now they've kicked us out of that. They all of a sudden started buying sorghum a couple years ago, and now they won't take sorghum. They've killed that market. So this is not one-sided, and we're not dealing with guys that don't take actions to serve themselves also.
Yeah, sure. Well, when I'm not hosting the 21st, I cover the State House, and so politics are always sort of top of my mind. Paul, I wanted to ask you, we had you on the 21st shortly after President Trump took office. How is the president doing when it comes to looking out for farmers?
Well, I think probably, unfortunately, some of his actions have been very, very disappointing. I think trade is extremely important to farmers, particularly in Illinois, and I think there's a lot of concern that what he thought was what we perceived as a change, as a shakeup, as a way of changing doing business and probably doing a better job of negotiating, I'm not sure we're seeing that, and I think there's a lot of concern and a lot of resentment from some of my neighbors that are just concerned about the way Washington is unable to get anything done. And a lot of that goes back to the leadership from the White House.
Mm-hmm. Well, we have just about a minute left. Wendell, I wanted to ask you, how have the decisions the Trump administration made on tariffs affected your views of the administration? Do you think that this track record could affect your decision at the ballot box in the next elections?
I've asked this question about why didn't you vote for Hillary? I just look at the alternative, the rules and regulations we'd have on us by her. There's no choice. And I'll give him some rope. I don't like the way he's done this, the way he's chosen to fight this battle, the way he's fighting on many fronts at once. I think that's a mistake. But I'm still sitting willing to give him a chance.
And finally, Evan, just in about 30 seconds, is there any one thing that you would like to see done to improve the situation for Illinois farmers, Evan?
Yeah, I think, and these guys, other guys here have alluded to it this morning, that, we realize there's problems with trade with other countries, but we need to find solutions through negotiation and not through tariffs. That's the big sticking point, I think, to help change the attitude of farmers towards this whole situation.
All right. Evan Hultin is a farmer. Paul Taylor is also a farmer. And Wendell Shauman, all farmers. Thank you so much for joining us today on the 21st.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for the opportunity.
Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey in for Nyla Boodoo. You've probably heard about the idea of a brain drain on where young people grow up, leave their hometowns, and never come back. We especially hear that when it comes to rural areas. But some parts of Illinois and across the country, local residents are trying to work together in new ways to reverse that trend, using community-building tools that are a lot more than just trying to get the next big company to set up shop nearby. Brittany Grimes is one of those people who defies the trend. She grew up in Galesburg in the western part of the state and has since moved back to work there and volunteer with Galesburg on Track. Brittany, welcome to the 21st.
Thank you for having me.
Before we get to the, some of the work you've been doing, I wanted to ask about your connection to Galesburg. You live there now and you're also from that area?
Yes, I am. Actually, my mother's side of the family was traditionally from Galesburg. Mother and her family were raised here. My grandfather actually served as an alderman for city council for many years, and he was actually the first African-American alderman in the city of Galesburg.
Well, but you went away for college, and then...
Absolutely. So I left away for to go to college at Virginia, so Virginia State University, went very, very far away. Also went to Maryland, got a degree, an MBA, and decided to come back home because it's home, and it's some place to be proud of, a place that I've always felt welcomed, and some place that I always want to make better.
Well, you know, it's so interesting because we often hear that if a young person leaves Illinois to go to college somewhere else, they're not likely to come back. What, you know, was there, what was the biggest reason? What was there any single factor that made you decide to move back?
You know, I think as much as they say that, hey, you know, we'll never come back. What it really was to me was this is where my history, my heritage is from. This is where my family is at. And it's really about contributing back to your community the best way that you know how. And so I knew that this would be the best place to be able to contribute back to the community. And I really wanted to take advantage of that by moving back. There's such a great options and hope and vibrancy that has now been built because of these programs that you're about to speak about. And I really wanted to make sure that I was a part of that.
When you first came back, what was it like?
It was a little... Coming from D.C., it's kind of a little jarring, I will say, because, you know, you're used to the hustle and bustle, and you have the opportunity here to take a step back and to really focus down on some things as opposed to having maybe some things that people may see as options, and sometimes they may be distractions. So it really gives you the opportunity to really focus down and to really pay attention to those things in life that you really care about.
This isn't your regular job, right? You're a volunteer in addition to your full-time job. When did you realize that you wanted to be involved with helping your town in a, you know, a more formal, organized way?
I've always wanted to and always tried to be a part of some type of volunteer activity. I think that's something that was been ingrained into me by my grandfather, and it's just something that you just look for opportunities in order to serve once again, and in order to make your community better. So it was really a call, clarion call, if you want to call it that way, to just want to once again make my community better. And so I was seeking out different ways to do so, and this opportunity presented itself. Actually, when I had first come home, I literally had only been home for a week, and we had a meeting that we were, Heart and Soul had a meeting with NAACP, and they said, hey, if you'd like to join the leadership team, we have this available. And Deb Moreno, who was the coordinator for it, I talked to her after because I had millions of questions. So how are you doing this? What's going on here? And all these different things. And she's like, hey, you know, feel free to join us. And I haven't stopped since.
You just mentioned Heart and Soul, community Heart and Soul, right? This is the framework you and others in Galesburg have been using. It comes from a group called the Orton Family Foundation. What does that entail for you?
So at the very beginning, it was really about organizing, of course, volunteers that would want to start this journey with us. And so once again, Deb did a great job of reaching out to different organizations throughout the town and trying to find those people who really wanted to be on that core team, who really wanted to be involved and who continuously wanted to invest in the community. And so once we did that, we were able to actually start talking to the town, start getting some feedback from the town about what they love about Galesburg, what they would leave about Galesburg. So you could find us at multiple different events around town. So we were at grocery stores, we were at teen dances, we were at we had different events that we threw to kind of pull the community together. We were at organizations events, once again, collecting all this data and information. And what we were able to get from that were the values, the things that we love about our community as opposed to the things that, you know, potentially we could do without. And we were able to move on from there. We actually also we facilitated an organization where all the people in town came to the firehouse. It was a kind of almost a town hall. And we had greater conversations so we can develop these value statements in order to create an action plan for the organizations of Galesburg to partake in. So it was really, once again, trying to get the community to have a voice, to have the community make sure that they know that they're being heard, to echo that back to the community and to engage the community in these activities that they find value in and they love so much.
Brittany Grimes is with Galesburg On Track. If you're just joining us, this is the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey in for Nyla Boodoo. We've been talking about what local residents in small towns do to try and improve their communities. I want to bring two more people into this conversation. Elise Montez is Director of Programs with the Orton Family Foundation. Giselle Hamm manages the Mapping the Future of Your Community program with the Illinois Institute for Rural Affairs at Western Illinois University. Elise, Giselle, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being here.
Thank you so much, Brian.
So, Elise, we've been hearing Brittany's story about Galesburg, and she moved away to college, came back a few years ago. She talked specifically about the model in her community called Community Heart and Soul. From a broader perspective, what are some of the most important parts of that program?
Yeah, good question. And I think, Brittany, thank you for all the details. And I, each community really experiences heart and soul and the journey differently and on their own. But we definitely have some key aspects that they follow as they go through that process. And it really is kind of a heart and soul initiative where, like a modern-day stone soup, just as she described. And I think, you know, in the beginning, it really is about getting all voices to the table and representation that is really demographically representative of your community. And so including voices that are not traditionally heard, there's a real intention in pulling people together. And then, of course, there's the aspect that she mentioned about going out and getting information from the community, and that's really done through a storytelling, story listening, story sharing approach. And it's through that approach that the community is actually developing relationships and getting to know one another and about itself really as a community in a much more strong and deep way. And then from that, using those elements to build what they want to do for actions in the future. So there's a lot more sense of ownership and accountability coming from a broader section of the community using Community Heart and Soul.
Giselle Hamm's also with us from Western Illinois University's Institute for Rural Affairs. She manages a program called Mapping the Future of Your Community. Giselle, what are some of the most important elements of that program? How is it similar or different from what Elise just mentioned?
Well, very, very similar to what was mentioned previously. Our program was actually created in 1991, really to engage community residents, as we knew, as we could see, as we worked in communities with the Institute. We could see there was really a need to engage the community, a diverse representation of the community around community and economic development efforts. Unlike our larger cities, our smaller rural communities just didn't have the resources, the financial resources, the human resources to hire someone to undertake community and economic development. And so it really took really a grassroots effort from the community to, help the community to thrive and grow. And so that's really what why we came about in 91, as the Institute identified that as a need. But really, you know, our focus is to engage volunteers, get people around a vision. So we help them to identify an overarching vision for the community, really looking out 10 to 30 years, which does include not only their core values, but also some high priority goals. Really, what is their ideal future for their community? So very similar to what the Community Heart and Soul is about as well.
Yeah. One of the things you both mentioned to our producer separately was shifting the focus from what a town doesn't have to what it does have, assets and opportunities that a town has to make a community a better place to live. And we heard Brittany talk about going from D.C. to Galesburg, and I want to come back to her in just a moment. But Elise, from a general perspective, why is that sort of emphasis important?
Well, I mean, it's clear we're seeing, you know, the divides across America, but divides have always have existed in whether it's newcomers and old-timers, different industry sectors. There's always a reason to sort of pit against each other, and I think there's a lot of capacity and asset in small towns, especially because you do know one another and you can help lift up one another by getting to know each other better. And I think, for us, we see the unintended or maybe the unexpected benefits of going into a community. And it's not us. Like, we give the community tools, as, you know, Brittany talked about, and, you know, the team of people, they're just using the tools that we've given them to kind of articulate that for themselves. And I think to come across what you all have in common is a much better place to start than what divides you. And we can argue and have debate around our divides until the cows come home, but until we can actually come together around what binds us and bonds us to our communities and what we love about where we live, we can't work together to move forward.
Brittany, what do you love about where you live in Galesburg?
I love the fact that Galesburg is always, we actually are home to one of the largest switchyards in the United States. And so I think one thing, we always used to have to go around trains. And I think the best example of this project is, no matter what's come our way and the town's way, we've always figured a way to get around it. And that's kind of how I feel about it. You know, as we've had to get around trains when they came through and maybe stopped us, and now we have these great overpasses and underpasses. But we were able to manage because we stuck together. We volunteered together. We made sure that we made plans together. And I like that sense of togetherness. I like that sense of volunteerism, that sense of we are wanting to be the best versions of ourselves. And that's what I really, really love about Galesburg, and that sense of pride that lives there.
Elise, I wanted to ask you, what are some of the biggest challenges here? This all sounds great, but it can still be hard, obviously, to attract people to small towns. We know recovery from the recession certainly was not equally distributed across the country. Elise, what are some of the headwinds you're facing?
Oh, that's a big one. I think in rural communities and small towns across America, we're looking at the similar challenges around access to health care and transportation, education, youth flight, opiate addictions. You know, there's all of these issues and challenges that towns, you know, even urban areas face, but are even more challenging for small and rural communities. And I think it's even ever more pressing of a need to have the communities come together and unify and not see those individual challenges as a family challenge. And even access to daycare, really good daycare in small and rural communities is a challenge. And so instead of seeing that as an individual family problem, it's a community challenge that we all need to resolve and work on together.
We're almost out of time, but Giselle, I wanted to ask you, a lot of this sounds like what, you know, a lot of people might think local government should be doing. Where, mm-hmm. Giselle, does local government come into play here?
Well, we certainly want local government to be a partner, and certainly any effort that comes out of our visioning and planning program, we want to complement what the local government is doing. But we also want to encourage others to come forward and be leaders. And so that's also part of our program, is really encouraging more leadership to come forward and assist the local government with various community and economic development efforts. And so it's a partnership.
All right. We've been talking to that was Giselle Hamm, who works with the Illinois Institute for Rural Affairs at Western Illinois University. We also heard from Elise Montez, Director of Programs with the Orton Family Foundation, and Brittany Grimes, a volunteer with Galesburg On Track. All three of you, thanks so much for joining us on the 21st.
Sure. Thank you.
Thank you.
That's all the time we have for today. You can follow the 21st on Twitter. Search for 21st Show. We live tweet during the show with more analysis and background about what we're talking about. On Facebook, we are the 21st. Search for us to like us. You can comment on what we're working on. And that and every other way to contact us is on our website, 21stshow.org. We're produced by Libby Foster, Robin Lynn, and Alan Montecilio. Tyler Panlilio is our intern. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Scott Cameron's our executive editor. I'm Brian Mackey, in for Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening.